This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Novelist and nature writer Brenda Peterson is our guest today. Her latest book is a novel, Animal Heart. It's a thriller and a love story, and it involves the environment. The novel examines a number of interesting subjects. The topics it delves into include the bonds between humans and animals and the wonder of that bond. Animal Heart also deals with the transplantation of animal organs into humans and the questions surrounding a type of military sonar and its effect on marine animals. Let me share the book's description with you. When an eerie mass stranding of whales and dolphins takes place along the mist-shrouded Oregon coast, forensic wildlife pathologist Isabel Spinner and her friend and co-worker Marion Windhorse Gray covertly investigate this disaster as a crime against wildlife. For years, Isabel has kept some emotional distance between herself and other humans while devoting herself to easing the suffering of animals. But when Isabel finally connects with Marshall McGregor, an undersea photographer whose recent transplant has him delving into the mystery surrounding his new heart, the two find themselves making surprising decisions that will forever change their lives. Listeners, I invite your questions this afternoon for Brenda Peterson. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Brenda Peterson is the author now of four novels, including Duck and Cover, which was selected as a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. She is the author or co-author of seven books of nonfiction, including Sightings, The Gray Whale's Mysterious Journey. And she has co-edited three anthologies, including one I spoke with her about some time ago, The Sweet Breathing of Plants, Women Writing on the Green World. Her new book, the novel Animal Heart, is published by Sierra Club Books. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Brenda Peterson, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure, Celeste.
So many ideas come together here within the covers of this book. I suspect, however, the bonds humans and animals are able to forge, as well as our responsibilities toward animals, is the story you're most interested in telling. Is that the case?
That's exactly the case. I wanted to tell a story that involved animals and their dramas as equal to our human dramas. And I also wanted to celebrate those wildlife volunteers who, without any pay, without much recognition, get up at 3 a.m. in the morning, run out for a whale stranding, go where a bird population has been part of an oil slick, rescue grizzly cubs, you know, take care of the animals of the world who often are not taken care of by the governments.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting. We can be a room full of strangers, and if an animal comes into the room, suddenly things warm up.
We're not strangers.
Yeah, and that happens too, doesn't it, with these folks who are in the business of animal rehabilitation and animal rescue.
I've met so many wonderful volunteers. And, you know, in this day and age of so many extinctions and looking at the world that we're going to leave our children and our grandchildren, the only antidote, really, I think, is to get engaged and to become part of a greater kinship system that includes all the other minds, all the other intelligences, all the other animals in our world. And that's something that someone like Jane Goodall talks a lot about with her Roots and Shoots program and some of the work I've done with school children, you know, children at risk. You go in there, maybe they've never seen an old forest, maybe they've never seen a whale, but you tell stories and immediately they remember. And they want to connect. And it's those children, I think, that in many ways I always keep in my mind when I'm writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, because we need to give them a world where there's whales, where there's wolves, where there's elk, where there's great blue heron. You know, that's our job as adults. I remember Ursula Le Guin, the wonderful writer, the novelist, was here in Seattle where I live, and a 13-year-old girl stood up in the audience and said, "Ms. Le Guin, what do you think the most important thing for you to do as a writer is?" And she said, "The most important thing for all of us adults to do is to give your generation hope."
Hmm.
So most of my writing, and certainly the book we talked about before with you, The Sweet Breathing of Plants, and all of my work with dolphins and whales, and certainly Animal Heart, is my animal heart given to the animal hearts of the next generation.
Yeah. Maybe you would talk with us about this character, Isabel Spinner. She's got a huge heart.
Yes, she does.
And it's good because she has to bear so much.
Yes, I'm really happy that you know that. Isabel Spinner is a character who has lost her own parents in a sailing boat accident, and she has also suffered a sense of loss when her brother kind of goes off and becomes a world traveler. But her primary relationship really is the Pacific Ocean and the marine mammals that she studies. And she works in a kind of crime scene investigation wildlife research lab that investigates crimes against animals. So, you know, think of that. Think of the fact that there are now federal agencies investigating crimes against animals. I just love that. It's high time. There are so many strange things that go on. People act out against animals. Certainly, many animals are beaten or they're massacred or horrible things happen to them. And those stories often go unwritten and untold. But there are these people who work. There's actually a lab in real life down in Oregon in Ashland, which is the lab that I based this fictional lab on, that will use DNA and the most modern science to say, well, this elk herd was decimated by a person who had a fiber in his jacket that matches the fiber of the defendant. And they are actually put in jail and fined. So I think this is a very big step forward for our species, that we actually understand that we have committed crimes against animals and are working to solve them. So Isabel, that's her job. And through that job, she's also a volunteer and an amateur naturalist. I think amateur naturalists will save the world. I think that science, they're so concerned with the academic world, with grants. They're afraid to lose their grants. And so often it's ordinary citizens, like people in the Sierra Club, who go out and say, "We're going to save this wetland." Or like Isabel says, "There's a mass stranding of whales. Why? Let's try to find out why these whales are dying."
Mm.
And that's one of the deeper plots of this novel.
Yeah.
That makes it a kind of eco-thriller.
Well, also we have this military sonar, and we have xenoplantation, thank you. And one of the issues that I wanted to talk with you about, or both of those issues I want to talk with you about, but involving both of those, you mentioned the amateur naturalists. You know, who's at the table talking about what we're going to do here on these issues?
You know, every government agency, by law, whether it's the Forest Service or the Park Service or the Natural Marines Fisheries Service, has to hold public hearings. And this is something that our democracy gives us. We are not in a country that just unilaterally makes decisions. Well, we certainly have had some of those recently, but in general, in our policy toward the natural world, we have a legal system and we have a system of public comment. So if there's a wildlife refuge, say in Illinois, that's being threatened by development, everyday citizens can just in their homes form some sort of a group, get together and become everyday activists, and they can actually stop development. I have a friend, Robin Cobale of Summertree Institute in Palm Springs, California, who's an ethnobotanist, who got together a group of people who said, "Let's not bulldoze 1,000-year-old cactus. You know, let's not rip these souls out of the ground." And she went out and formed this group, and they went to all the meetings. And then instead of making the bulldozers or the developmental people her enemy, she decided to use education, and she went out to all the bulldozer drivers, and she said, here's how you recognize a 1,000-year-old cactus. And some of the bulldozer drivers wept and said, we don't want to destroy these beautiful old plants. We just don't know what they are. And that's a wonderful story of how just one single person got together a group of neighbors and are saving ancient plants.
Mm-hmm. Xenotransplantation and the military's interest in active sonar, these are issues that ethicists and others are struggling with, and I wonder if your desire to either explore these issues and or to raise some flags led you to write a novel about them.
Yes, Celeste. I had been writing a lot of nonfiction. I had done a book on the gray whale for National Geographic Books, and I had also done a book for Sierra Club on the dolphins, celebrating the dolphin-human bond. It's called Between Species. And in the course of my 20 years of studying marine mammals, everywhere I went at these conferences, these biologists and these naturalists and these scientists would come up to me and they would say, almost as if this was some sort of desperate secret that they had to get out to the world, please tell the story of what's happening to our oceans and our marine mammals, and eventually to our divers and to our people and to our habitat with this military active sonar. Those of you who don't live on the coast may not be as aware mm-hmm. of the marine environment, but certainly you have a lot of water there, so you have a lot of water people. And what happens is that the sonar is a low frequency, a mid frequency. It's a very huge, horrible, hideous noise. I won't play it for you on the radio here because it's so horrible to hear that people just can't bear it. And what happens is it's like standing next to a jet plane at takeoff without any protection. The human body, everything is vibrations, sound vibrations, and these are masters of acoustics, these marine mammals. So they live by navigating by sound in a world where often they cannot see. So what happens is when you put this terrible noise in the ocean and you send it out for 1,000 miles, it literally implodes the tissue. At 150 decibels, human being tissue will be ruptured. At 235 decibels, which is what they've been blasting it at recently off Canary Islands and off Hawaii, literally the ear bones shatter, the lungs rupture, the brain hemorrhages. It's like a bomb going off inside your body, made out of sound. My scientist friend Ken Balcom, who's an orca expert, calls them acoustic bullets. And they go into the mind and they cannot come out. I mean, it's perhaps one of the most horrible ways I can imagine to die. And it's all out of our hearing range because it's underwater. So what happened about, 1998, I first started covering this, is that I realized the scientists weren't going to stop it. The government was not going to stop it because the government is so much concerned with the military, and the military is supporting so much of the marine mammal research. So there's a conflict of interest there. It was going to have to be everyday people like you, like me, who write their congresspeople and say, we do not want to destroy our oceans and our marine mammals and our habitat because the oceans are our life support. And that's what's happening right now all over the world. There was a stranding in the Bahamas in 2000, in the spring of 2000. And fortunately, Ken Balcom was there with his scientists, and he took these stranded mammals and got necropsies, which is an autopsy of an animal, sent them to a Harvard pathologist, and they got definitive proof and forced the Navy to take responsibility for the sonar. Now, the Navy has taken responsibility only after the evidence in every single case. In last month alone, right after this book came out, there's been a stranding off of Hawaii, a stranding off of the Canary Islands after the NATO naval exercises, and there's been research that's now definitive that says sonar causes whale deaths. It's been all over the New York Times. It's been all over the West Coast papers. And now it's probably going to be moving more to the East Coast because the Navy is applying to put the sonar off the target range of North Carolina and target practice in a right whale area. And also, environmental exemptions have been given by Congress to not in any way interfere with the sonar. So it's been given a green light, even though a federal judge in San Francisco ruled in the fall of 2003 that this sonar was lethal and could not be used except for in 1% of the world's oceans. And then Congress came along in this administration and said, we're in a time of war, mm-hmm. we will use anything we can, and they've given the green light. So that's where we are. Our fear and our terror is destroying our life support system. How ironic.
You know, you said the Navy has taken responsibility, but they're still using this technology.
Exactly.
And, you know, the military is also required to this is something you alluded to earlier, produce an environmental impact statement
exactly.
before deploying technology like this. So what does the Navy have to say for itself?
The Navy has to say that they think these are isolated incidents, that they believe that they can work together with certain scientists whom they have hired, actually, because 90% of marine mammal research comes from the Department of Defense. Now, that seems very strange to me, that the Department of Defense is supposedly supporting scientific research. You know there is going to be a conflict of interest there. The environmental impact statements right now, there are so many people trying to stop the sonar, but we really need help because the administration is so much about using the military and frightening people, so that we may make decisions right now out of our own fear that leave no habitat for our children or our grandchildren. I mean, it's as if in World War II people would get so afraid that they would have, you know, wrecked all of our farmlands. I mean, we have to think generations ahead and not just let our own current fears destroy what will feed and take care of our next generations. For example, in the sonar that's been using, it affects gray whale migrations. It affects fish migrations. It destroys habitat in the marine systems. And this is something that our oceans are already so polluted, so heavily damaged by runoff, you know, by oil spills, by PCBs. We really can't afford to do anything more that is going to harm our oceans. So if people are wondering what they could do, I don't want to just leave them with a sense of you know, hopelessness. There are people who are bravely standing up and really stopping this in the courts. The first people I would recommend would be the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC.org. And they have been the ones who have been doing all the suits against the U.S. Navy. And on their website, there's a lot of information. Also, OrcaNetwork.org up here in my area of the Puget Sound, they have lots of information about the sonar. And Ken Balcom is leading the scientific research against it. I do think that we could turn the tide, so to speak, if we had people, even if just 100,000 people in this country got actively involved in this issue, we could make a big difference.
You've been studying marine animals for some time. Would you share some of what you've learned about the interactions between dolphins and humans?
We are so curious about dolphins, and that makes sense because we are highly intelligent as a species. We have families, we have complex societies, we have very complex communication skills. And when we look out into the natural world, we look at other big-brained mammals. I mean, they are mammals. They are our cousins in the sea. They breathe air. They nurse their young. They have very complex family systems. They are matrilineal, which means that there's a lot less violence among dolphins and among orcas. We were just up this past weekend with this is a wonderful group of orcas, the southern residents, who are the biggest dolphin, as you know, the black and white killer whales, as they are very badly called, because they do not kill, they could call killer humans, but orcas are up there. They've been there. They've been studied for 30 years. Ken Balcom is studying them. We were on a boat, and all of a sudden, the matriarch, Granny, came by with her son, Ruffles, and then his brother, Raggedy. And here is a 94-year-old orca, and she is still giving birth. And she is the matriarch of all of these other orcas. You know, orca males stay with their mothers for their entire lifetimes. And these are long lifetimes during which they have very complex communication. There are people up at Orca Lab who are listening with hydrophones every day to these southern and northern residents. And you can actually go on your computer. This is what I love about interspecies communication. You can go on your computer to Orca Lab, and you can listen live to the hydrophones where the orcas go by, and you can also visually, if you have a broadband or something, see them going by the cameras at this research center. And people from Japanese school children to people in Norway to people in Mexico get online and they say, I've been following this matriarch Granny for the last 10 years, and it seems to me that, and then they have conversations about the family of orcas. Now, Jane Goodall began that research by naming the chimpanzees, and Ken picked that up by naming the orcas. Even though the scientists named them A37, A46, the fact is these are real families having real struggles. There was a newborn that died recently. There was a new birth. And it's just wonderful. It's like whale net, you know, people having conversations about family as if they were part of their own kinship system. And that's one of the things that I really celebrate about the humanity of our species and the compassion, that here we are reaching out to other families that are not necessarily human.
Mm. What is it, do you suppose, that's at the heart of this connection we have with animals?
We are animals. We are animals. We, you know, the very first pictures that we painted as a human ancestor primitive, I think it was probably, Australopithecine? I don't know for sure. Neanderthals certainly buried their dead and put tokens of animals with them. We painted our first stories on caves, and we painted animals. And the animals, those Lascaux cave paintings, you know, in France, those animals are so beautiful. And the humans are stick figures. I think somehow we knew our place in those days. You know, we knew that we were among the most beautiful predators on Earth. We knew that we worshipped animals, that we saw them as teachers. The wolves taught us to hunt. You know, the whales taught us to fish. And we understood that we were in a very profound interrelationship with other animals. Mm. And those of us who have never forgotten that kinship are really, I think, in the majority, but we have been either too shy to talk about it. Like you said, when people come together, they may be a little shy, or, you know, they may not start talking, but immediately they will talk about their cats or their dogs. And they will then tell stories about themselves vis-a-vis their animal kinship systems. And I do think that we really are coming back into this 21st century where we know that we have been too far away from our sisters and brothers under the skin, as my father used to call the animals. They were our sisters and brothers under the skin.
Mm. You know, I think another thing that fascinates us is that as we communicate, animals communicate with one another. And now we're thinking about animal-human communication.
Yes.
And that's something also that you deal with in this novel, Animal Heart. Maybe you'd tell us something about what you've learned over time about animal communication and animal-human communication.
Well, two stories come to mind. The first one is actually from my novel, Animal Heart, which we're talking about. And that is that these primates, these gorillas, these chimpanzees like Washoe, the famous chimpanzee who learned sign language, working with Roger Fouts over here in eastern Washington at the Chimpanzee Institute there, they learned our language, and suddenly a whole world opened up. And we said, oh, no, we have forgotten to listen to these animals who have now graciously learned our sign language. And they can talk to each other and pass on the sign language as Washoe has to her offspring. There's a scene in the novel, which I think is perhaps one of my very favorite, in which a busload of children pulls up to this actual institute that I named the CHCI Institute over in Eastern Washington that studies primate human communication. And the children pile off, and they're deaf, and they know American Sign Language. And they begin to talk with the chimpanzees, who have also been taught through generations sign language. And there's this amazing coming together of children of our species with young chimpanzees having a conversation about how they like the food and how they like their siblings, and they're talking. And I don't think we have ever seen anything like this, and science has brought us this. Just yesterday in our Seattle newspaper, there's research being done at the University of Washington on macaw monkeys who are using computers, and they're finding that their intelligence level is the same as a three-year-old human infant. In fact, at a certain time, they are a little ahead of us, and then our big brains kind of take over. So that is a very exciting discovery, that we can actually talk to animals as indigenous people have always talked, and the shamans have become animals and come back and told stories of the animal wisdom to the tribe. We are now actually in our science talking. And the story of the animal that actually Jane Goodall told me a while back, she was going through the animal research labs, and I think this is perhaps one of the things that helped me, inspire me to write about the xenotransplantation, which is the transplantation of animal organs into humans, which is a very dark and a very disturbing part of our future genetic science. And she told me the story of going through a lab, and there was an animal that was actually I think this was in the Roger Fouts book, but she told it to me from that book. And an animal who had been a lab experiment animal who had learned American Sign Language saw Roger going through, and he recognized him from earlier experiments, but he was now in a medical research lab being used for all these horrible medical research techniques. And he reached out through the bars and said in sign language to Roger Fouts, "Help me." So what do we do with that when the animals ask us directly, "Help me"?
Where are we today in xenotransplantation?
We are farther along than I had ever dreaded. We are now in a stage where, you know, there were the baboon hearts, and certainly my character receives a baboon heart, and much of that particular baboon directly to human research has been banned because we were in fear of a species like baboons transmitting to humans a disease like AIDS. It just takes one transplant to start an epidemic like AIDS. And in fact, you know, AIDS began in Africa, where the chimpanzee virus, through the bushmeat trade, was infected with the people who ate that meat. And that's how we got AIDS in our species. So the particular direct baboon to human transplant is illegal. And in fact, the one that goes on the book is illegal. But there is a new route that they're taking now through pigs. So they are splicing baboon hearts onto pigs. They kill the baboon, they take the heart, they splice it onto the pig, and they're trying to use then pigs that they will then harvest organ by organ and transplant into humans. And this may sound like 1984, but Frontline just did a huge program on it a couple years ago. When I began writing about it, it was really just beginning. And now it's exploded. Biotechnology. There are visions of organ farms in our future that are happening right now, where animals are simply harvested organ by organ, you know, like their farmland. And those organs will be put directly either into a pig and then into a human, or at some point directly into a human. And the ethics of that are something that we must think about.
Yeah, the ethical issues are just so many, and they are huge.
It's one thing to eat an animal. You know, I am anemic, so I unfortunately can't be a total vegetarian. I have to eat fish and chicken every now and then just to stay healthy. But, you know, so I do feel that I'm kind of in between the strong vegetarians and the strong, you know, meat eaters, and I try to mediate. But it's one thing to eat an animal, especially an animal that was harvested humanely or that was raised in a, you know, in a free-range situation or a natural beef situation. That's one thing, because you know the animal had a life and then was killed humanely. It's another thing to take animals who are conscious, who know that they're in prison, who can feel suffering and feel pain, and separate them from their families in the wild and put them in tiny cages and then take their organs. I mean, that is something that I think is so barbaric. And even if we can do it scientifically, all of the questions in Animal Heart are asking, just because we have the science, just because we have the sonar, should we kill our oceans with it? Just because we have the potential to transplant a heart from an animal into a human, should we do it ethically, morally? What is the spiritual consequence of this kind of expediency?
Mm.
And that's why Marshall, who has a baboon heart, begins to remember the African savanna and remember his mate and remember his baboon troop and goes out to try to find the mate of his new heart. And that's the other plot in Animal Heart. I took on a lot in that book. I hope people are, it's getting very good reviews, and I'm a little bit shocked because I do feel like I was bringing up a lot of issues. But I think the world is ready now in the 21st century to talk about these issues.
Hmm. Very interesting. I mean, to sit back and read this book and then think about all the subjects that you're dealing with here. And, you know, it's funny, to prepare for the interview, I went online and I looked for information on the sonar and xenotransplantation because I wondered, has Brenda entered the realm of science fiction here?
Yes.
And not so. But I do wonder, have these issues felt like science fiction to you as you sat down and worked on this book?
Thank you for doing that research. I just love it when interviewers do all, are so prepared. You know, it began to seem like science fiction when I first started writing this book 8 years ago. But as I began to research it, it actually started coming to life. And that was the eerie thing about writing this book. It has come to life as I've barely been able to keep up with the news. And all the science in Animal Heart is based on fact. And the fact does seem like science fiction, but it's not. And that's why I think it's, you know, it's going to be a movie at some point. And when the Hollywood agent took it on, he said, you know, this must be science fiction. And I said, no. And I sent him just, you know, maybe one FedEx pack of my research. And he wrote back and he said, oh, my God, this is real. This is happening. This is the future.
Mm.
It's now.
Mm.
So that's why there's an urgency also, I think, about this book, because unlike some of the other books I've written that are more, you know, timeless, perhaps, this book really is written for this audience, for now, for us to ask these questions, so that maybe we can stop ourselves before we do really terrible damage to our habitat, to our animals, and to our souls.
Mm. I want to talk about that idea here in just a moment, but I think what I should do now is reintroduce you, Brenda.
Thank you.
Because it's been a while, and the time is just flying past here. Novelist and nature writer Brenda Peterson is our guest today. Her latest book is a novel, Animal Heart. It examines a number of interesting subjects. The topics it delves into include the bonds between humans and animals and the wonder of that bond. It also deals with the transplantation of animal organs into humans, xenotransplantation, and the questions surrounding a type of military sonar and its effect on marine animals. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Brenda Peterson's new book, Animal Heart, published by Sierra Club Books. Well, now let's go back to this idea of our use of animals and our heart and soul, and we can talk more coolly about the ethics of it, but I want to talk with you about this character that you have in the book, Marshall McGregor, and another character. Marshall has been given the heart of a baboon. This other character has within her a pig valve.
Yeah.
And there is a scene where the two of them visit the zoo.
Yes.
And Marshall is, would it be fair to say he's fairly overcome?
Yes. Yes. He is a man who has not, he is an underwater photographer, and of course he cares very much about the marine habitat and coral reefs. But when he suddenly gets this heart of another species, he begins to have flashbacks to the African savanna and the baboon that belonged to or was part of the family of the heart that he now has. And, you know, this is actually based on human research in which human transplant heart recipients have memories, have changes in their eating habits, have quirks, and they feel compelled to find the donor of their heart or the families and make what's called a grateful apology for receiving these hearts. And they go and they'll find that, you know, they've been having these cravings at the age of, you know, 60 to ride a motorcycle, and they'll go and they'll find that the young man's heart they have belonged to someone who was killed on a motorcycle and loved riding in motorcycles. And so these people who have written about this in books like Change of Heart, they say, you know, what does it mean that I have someone's heart in me and I have a whole new set of emotions and quirks and possibilities? And it often leads heart transplant patients into all sorts of, I would think, spiritual and emotional searching. So by the same token, I just supposed, with my bond with animals, that Marshall would become very obsessed with the baboon troop from which he received this heart. And he does. He fights it because he's not a person who's, like Isabel, so immediately drawn to kind of crossing over into the world of animals. And he's in denial, and he's also depressed, like many heart transplants. And he goes with Irene, who's had a pig valve transplant, and they go to the zoo, and they see for the first time, I think he focuses on a baboon troop at the zoo, and he sees the tenderness, almost like a Madonna, between the mother baboon and her infant, and how the family members take such good care of that newborn and how cherished that young newborn is. And something in his heart responds, and he then feels called to go outside of his own human world and help rescue animals in medical research centers, which is a huge step for him because he's not an animal activist. He's someone more middle of the road, you know, never thinks about it much. But suddenly this new heart is opening up to him a whole new world of kinship.
Yeah. Now, Isabel Spinner, clearly, from the very outset of the book, when readers encounter her, they'll understand she's long felt a deep connection to the animals that live in the waters off the coast of Oregon, her home. And Marshall, he's an undersea photographer. And the two of them are, it would seem that they're a perfect pair. And I don't want to say too much about the story, but on the one hand, Isabel and Marshall seem like such a perfect pair. But on the other hand, you know, how is it that an undersea photographer, someone who will like Isabel, maybe not quite as connected to the world of animals as Isabel is, how is it that, you know, he considers the transplant, and, you know, what does maybe you would tell us what Isabel has to what she thinks about it? How do they negotiate these issues?
Well, you know, I really do want to make this very clear to your listeners that Animal Heart is first and foremost a love story. I knew that to tell a story that has all these issues of science and xenotransplantation and the horrors of military sonar, I couldn't do it in nonfiction. I had to do it in a human way, in an entertaining way, and in a way that had love and celebration of the things that are the best about our species and others. And when I found Isabel, and then I found Marshall, because, you know, you wander around for a while until the characters finally reveal themselves, I hoped that they would fall in love, but I didn't know that they would fall in love, and I had to wait for them to fall in love. And so when it happens in the book and they do fall in love, I was so thrilled. It's like matchmaking. You say, come on, you come to dinner and you come to dinner, but sometimes you can put two characters in a room and they hate each other. And I would say that some of the most difficult and exciting work of this book was telling the love story of Marshall and Isabel, and then expanding their love story to include Mac and Molly, who are a pair of empathic dolphins whom they rescue after a stranding. And there's a scene in the aquarium, which is one of the favorite love scenes I've ever written, in which Marshall and Isabel are in their wetsuits in the aquarium, surrounded by these baby dolphins. And the dolphins are very interested in the fact that these humans are falling in love.
Hmm.
So the love story, you know, I've just kind of realized that there's going to be a sequel to Animal Heart, and I've started writing it. But I can't tell you anything about it because it would give away the ending of this book.
Well, it's funny because you say that, because I think when we think of, you know, animals as members of the family, we think of our cats and dogs. But here you've got a different kind of family going altogether here, don't you?
Yes, and of course they are families. You know, when we see these, we call them perfect empathic pairs. Many of your listeners may be horse people. So that originally comes from horses. You know, they get into these pairs and they whinny for each other if they're separated. They move kind of in sync. Well, translate that to the sea, and you see these orcas who breathe together consciously. They take each breath with consciousness. So if they get knocked out, they drown. Unlike humans, we breathe unconsciously with that good old reptilian brain. So here you have, talk about empathy, talk about moving in a kind of symmetry and sympathy with each other. We have a lot to learn from animals who use empathy as one of their survival ways of bonding. And certainly the empathy between Mac and Molly helps. I can't tell you what happens to them because I want people to read this book, but Mac and Molly are major characters, and their love story is also a parallel to Marshall and Isabel. So we have marine mammals falling in love, and we have humans falling in love. And it's a different kind of love in each sense, because Isabel and Marshall can actually mate, and these other two are different species and wouldn't mate. But they are in an empathic pair. And when you think about what that means, that you breathe together as you move through the seas, how much tuned in to each other you have to be. I don't know too many husbands and wives who can breathe together.
No, I don't think so. even though you're really close.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and intimate. No, that would be something. We are out of time. We did have a listener call in who wanted to know if you would again mention the environmental group that's bringing lawsuits against the sonar, and I believe it was the NRDC?
Yes.
Okay. So that's
Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC.org.
Okay. And then also we should check out Orca Live, huh?
Orca Live and OrcaNetwork.org. One to listen in to the orcas and their communications up in the British Columbia area, and the other to get involved in all of the marine mammal issues on the West Coast. And bless you, land people, for caring about us and the habitat here, because these oceans are for everybody.
Yeah. Well, it's good to talk with you from from the middle of the country.
Yes.
Where we don't have, we have water. We have lots of beautiful water, but we don't have an ocean.
And you have 90% of your bodies made out of water.
Well, thank you very much, Brenda, for talking with me today.
My pleasure, Celeste.
Brenda Peterson is a novelist and nature writer. Her latest book is a novel, Animal Heart, and it is published by Sierra Club Books.